adherence to foreign rule, Enver took drastic action. On 23 January 1913, 10 armed conspirators galloped through the cobbled streets of Istanbul to the offices of the Sublime Porte. As they burst into the cabinet meeting, Enver and his men exchanged gunfire with the Grand Vizier's guards. 4 men, including the Minister of War, Nazım Pasha, were killed in the shootout before Enver pressed his pistol to Kamil Pasha's head to demand the Grand Vizier's resignation. "It was all over in a quarter of an hour," Enver later confided. He then made his way to the palace to inform the Sultan of his actions and to seek the nomination of a new Grand Vizier. Sultan Mehmed V named a veteran statesman and former general, Mahmud Shevket Pasha, to form a national unity government. Within 4 hours of the notorious raid on the Sublime Porte, a new cabinet had been appointed, tasked with restoring stability to the war-shattered politics of the Ottoman Empire. Though its members had led the coup against Kamil Pasha's government, the CUP still did not exploit the opportunity to seize political power. Mahmud Shevket Pasha was sympathetic to the CUP, but he was no unionist. The new Grand Vizier was encouraged to create a non-partisan coalition to provide stability and unity after the factionalism and military disasters of the recent past. Only 3 unionists were appointed to his cabinet, all of them moderates. The future triumvirs of the Ottoman Empire, Talat, Enver and Jamal, remained out of government for the moment. Jamal accepted the post of military governor of Istanbul. Talat continued as secretary-general of the CUP, and Enver went to war. When war resumed, it went badly for the Ottoman Empire. The armistice expired without agreement between the belligerents on 3 February 1913. With key cities under siege and no line of communication to resupply or relieve them, the Ottomans watched helplessly as, one by one, their last European possessions fell to the ambitious Balkan states. The Greeks took the Macedonian town of Ioannina in modern Greece, on 6 March. Montenegrin forces pinned down Ottoman defenders in Ishkodra, Shkoda in modern Albania. Yet the cruelest blow came when the Bulgarians starved the defenders of Edirne into capitulation on 28 March, a moment of profound national crisis for the Ottoman Empire as a whole. Mahmud Shevket Pasha offered an immediate truce shortly after the fall of Edirne. Negotiations resumed between the Ottomans and the Balkan states in London at the end of May, and a full peace treaty was concluded under British mediation on 30 May 1913. In the Treaty of London, the Ottoman government signed away 60,000 square miles of territory and nearly 4 million inhabitants, surrendering all its European possessions except a small portion of eastern Thrace, the hinterlands of Istanbul, defined by the Midye-Enez line. As in the Italian-Turkish War, the Ottomans had suffered total defeat. Losing Libya was nothing compared to ceding Albania, Macedonia, and Thrace. Since being conquered from the Byzantine Empire 5 centuries earlier, these European territories had been the economic and administrative heart of the Ottoman world. They ranked among the most prosperous and developed provinces in the empire. The loss of revenues was compounded by the high costs of the First Balkan War to the Ottoman treasury. Thousands of refugees needed resettlement, and disease swept their squalid camps. The government also faced tremendous expenses to rebuild the Ottoman army after the losses in men and materiel incurred through 2 failed wars. Perhaps the greatest obstacle the Ottomans faced was one of public morale. It was bad enough to lose a war to a relatively advanced European power like Italy, but neither the Ottoman army nor the general public could accept defeat at the hands of small Balkan states that had once been part of their empire. The Bulgar, the Serb, the Greek, our subjects of 5 centuries whom we have despised, have defeated us, wrote Yusuf Akçura, a young Turk intellectual. This reality, which we could not conjure up even in our imaginations, will open our eyes if we are not yet entirely dead. Throughout the 19th century, pessimistic Europeans had labelled the Ottoman Empire the sick man of Europe. Even the most optimistic young Turks could not rule out the sick man's demise by the end of the First Balkan War. Defeat polarized politics in Istanbul. The CUP had justified its coup d'état against Kamil Pasha's liberal government in January 1913 as a necessary measure to prevent the loss of Edirne. Now that Edirne had fallen, the liberals were determined to settle old scores and drive the unionists from politics. Cemal, a leading unionist politician and military governor of Istanbul, deployed agents to monitor everyone he suspected of plotting against the non-partisan government. Despite his best efforts, Cemal was unable to protect the Grand Vizier. On 11 June, just days after the signing of the Treaty of London ceding Edirne, gunmen shot Mahmud Shevket Pasha dead outside the Sublime Porte. The unionists turned the turmoil following the Grand Vizier's assassination to political advantage. Cemal unleashed a purge that broke the power of the liberals once and for all. Scores were arrested, 12 leaders were given swift trials and executed on 24 June, and a number of leading opposition figures abroad were condemned to death in absentia. Dozens more were sent into exile. Once they had eliminated their liberal opponents, the unionists took power. Ever since the 1908 revolution, the Young Turks had chosen to stay out of government. Finally, in 1913, they were determined to rule. The Sultan invited Said Halim Pasha, a unionist and member of the Egyptian royal family, to form the next government in June 1913. The most influential Young Turks emerged in national leadership positions for the first time in Said Halim's cabinet. Enver, Talat, and Cemal were all promoted to the rank of Pasha, the highest grade in both civil and military service. Talat Pasha entered the cabinet as Minister of Interior. Enver Pasha emerged as one of the most powerful generals in the army, and in January 1914 was made Minister of War. Cemal Pasha remained Governor of Istanbul. After 1913, they would emerge as the ruling triumvirate of the Ottoman Empire, more powerful than the Sultan or his Grand Vizier, that is, the Ottoman Prime Minister. The CUP rose to uncontested power when the unionist-led government recovered Edirne in July 1913. This was, in fact, a gift from Bulgaria's Balkan rivals. The tenuous division of spoils between the victorious states following the First Balkan War was undone when the European powers recognized Albania's declaration of independence. Austria and Italy in particular supported the creation of Albania as a buffer to contain Serbia and prevent it from becoming a new maritime power on the Adriatic. The European powers forced Serbia and Montenegro to withdraw from the Albanian territory they had conquered in the First Balkan War. The Serbs, frustrated by the loss of Albanian lands, sought satisfaction in Macedonian territory held by Bulgaria and Greece. The Bulgarians, convinced they had done most of the fighting against the Turks, refused to cede any territory to the Serbs and rejected Russian efforts at mediation. On the night of 29 to 30 June 1913, the Bulgarians attacked Serb and Greek positions in Macedonia, sparking the Second Balkan War. Bulgaria found itself taking on all its Balkan neighbours, as Romania and Montenegro allied with Greece and Serbia against Bulgaria. Overextended, the Bulgarians were forced to redeploy their troops away from the Ottoman frontier to staunch their losses against Greece and Serbia. It was precisely the opening that Enver had been hoping for, yet still he encountered resistance from Said Halim Pasha's government, ever fearful that further military adventures could provoke the demise of the empire. If those officially charged with governing lack the courage to order the army into battle, Enver wrote, I will make it march without orders. Enver finally received his orders and led a detachment of cavalry and infantry across the recently demarcated border towards Edirne. As the Ottoman forces approached Edirne on 8 July, they came under fire from the Bulgarian defenders. Enver held his troops back until, persuaded the Bulgarians were evacuating the city, he was able to enter Edirne the following day unopposed. He dispatched a cavalry unit to pursue the retreating Bulgarians while reinforcing Ottoman positions in the war-devastated city. The joy of liberating Edirne was tempered by the humanitarian disaster that confronted the Ottoman soldiers. Enver described the horrors of the poor Turks squatting in their ruined houses, the elderly with atrocious scars, the orphans reliant on government charity, the thousands of atrocities which I encounter at every step. Over the month of July, Ottoman troops reoccupied most of eastern Thrace, as Bulgaria suffered defeat at the hands of its Balkan neighbours. On 10 August, Bulgaria sued for peace, leaving Edirne and eastern Thrace securely in Ottoman hands. Enver was celebrated once again. The hero of freedom was now declared the liberator of Edirne. The public response across the empire was euphoric. For its role in securing victory after so many humiliating defeats, the CUP gained unprecedented support from the Ottoman public. Noting how he had gained the admiration of the entire Muslim world for this exploit, Enver gloried in his latest triumph. "I am happy as a child," he confided to his German friend Hans Humann, "for having been the only one who could leap into Edirne in just one night." Buffeted by war and political turmoil, the Young Turk regime failed to live up to the liberal ideals of the 1908 revolution. The Unionists responded to external threats and internal challenges by tightening their grip on those provinces that remained indisputably under Ottoman control. The government adopted a number of policies intended to combat the centripetal forces pulling the empire apart by centralizing government more efficiently. The rule of law, including such unpopular measures as taxation and conscription, would be applied with equal rigor across all provinces of the empire without exception, and all Ottomans would be pressed to use Turkish in their official interactions with the state. These centralizing measures targeted the Arab provinces in a bid to prevent the emergence of separatist nationalist movements that might lead the Arabs to follow the Balkans into independence. Increasingly, after 1909, the Ottoman Turkish language displaced Arabic in schools, courtrooms, and government offices in the provinces of Greater Syria and Iraq. Senior government appointments went to Turkish officials, while experienced Arab civil servants were left to fill lower-level jobs. Predictably, these unpopular measures drove many loyal Arab subjects, disappointed by the authoritarian turn of the Young Turk Revolution, to form civil society organizations to oppose Turkification. Not yet nationalist, these pre-war Arabist societies called for greater Arab cultural and political rights within the framework of the Ottoman Empire. In the course of the Great War, however, a growing number of these Arab activists aspired to outright independence. Arabist societies were established in Istanbul and in the Arab provinces. Arab members of the Ottoman Parliament played an active role in the meetings of the Istanbul-based Arab-Ottoman Brotherhood Association and the Literary Club, which debated cultural matters of common concern. Reform societies were created in Beirut and Basra, and the National Scientific Club opened in Baghdad. These societies met openly, with the full knowledge of the Ottoman authorities, and came under the full scrutiny of the secret police. Two of the most influential Arabist societies were established beyond the reach of Ottoman censors and police. The Young Arab Society, also known as Al-Fatat, from its Arabic name Jamia al-Arabiya al-Fatat, was founded by a group of Syrian Muslims in Paris in 1909. Al-Fatat sought Arab equality within the framework of an Ottoman Empire reconceived as a binational Turco-Arab state, on the model of the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg Empire. As Tawfiq al-Natur, one of the founders of the party, recalled, "All that we, as Arabs, wanted was to have the same rights and obligations in the Ottoman Empire as the Turks themselves, and to have the empire composed of two great nationalities, Turk and Arab." In Cairo, a group of like-minded Syrian emigres established the Ottoman Decentralization Party in 1912. In a direct rejection of Young Turk's centralizing policies, the Cairo-based Arabists argued that the Ottoman Empire, with all its ethnic and racial diversity, could only be ruled through a federal system that conceded significant autonomy to the provinces. They took for their role model the decentralized government of Switzerland, with its autonomous cantons. Yet the decentralization party upheld the unity of the empire under the Ottoman Sultanate and advocated the use of Turkish alongside the local language of each province. The Unionists viewed the proliferation of Arabist societies with mounting concern. At the height of the Balkan Wars, the Young Turks were in no mood to compromise with demands for decentralization or dual monarchies. When, in February 1913, the Beirut Reform Society published a manifesto calling for administrative decentralization, the Ottoman authorities clamped down. On 8 April 1913, police closed the offices of the Beirut Reform Society and ordered the organization to disband. The influential members of the society called for a citywide strike and organized petitions to the Grand Vizier protesting the closure. Several society members were arrested for agitation. Beirut entered a period of intense political crisis that lasted 1 week until the prisoners had been released and the strike brought to an end. But the Beirut Reform Society never reopened its doors, and its members were forced to meet in secret as Arabism went underground. Faced with mounting Ottoman opposition, the Arabists took their cause to the international community. Members of Al-Fatat in Paris decided to convene a meeting in the French capital in order to enjoy the freedom to discuss politics without fear of Ottoman repression and to raise international support for their demands. Invitations were dispatched to Arabist societies in the Ottoman Empire, Egypt, Europe, and the Americas. Despite the best efforts of the Ottoman ambassador in France to prevent the meeting from taking place, 23 delegates from across the Arab provinces of the empire, 11 Muslims, 11 Christians, and 1 Jew, arrived in Paris to take part in the first Arab Congress, which opened before an audience of 150 observers on 18 June 1913. Tawfiq el-Suwaidi, a native of Baghdad, was one of only two Iraqi delegates to the Arab Congress. Suwaidi's friend, the Jewish delegate Suleiman Anbar, was also from Baghdad. All of the other participants hailed from Greater Syria. Suwaidi was a recent convert to Arabist politics. "I knew I was an Arab Ottoman Muslim," he later reflected, "though I only possessed the most ill-defined sense of myself as Arab." Fluent in Turkish, Suwaidi had completed a law degree in Istanbul in 1912 before moving to Paris to continue his legal studies. While in Paris, he fell in with a group of Arabists who profoundly influenced his political views. Suwaidi joined Al-Fatat and played a key role in organizing the Arab Congress. "The first Arab Congress," Suwaidi recalled, "turned out to be the theatre for a grand quarrel among three distinct factions. The first group was the Muslim Arab youth, who sought to enjoy rights equal to those accorded Turkish subjects of the empire. The second faction comprised the Arab Christians, who were full of bitter hatred for the Turks. Suwaidi dismissed the third faction as fence-sitters, men he saw as opportunists who were unable to choose between loyalty to the Turks and loyalty to the Arabs, and would ultimately side with whatever party best advanced their material interests. In 6 days of sessions, the Congress agreed on 10 resolutions framing the delegates' reform agenda. They demanded Arab political rights and the active participation of Arabs in the administration of the Ottoman Empire through decentralization. They demanded that Arabic be recognized as an official language of the empire and that Arab deputies be allowed to address Parliament in their native tongue. They sought to restrict military service to the recruits' home provinces, except in very exceptional circumstances. The Congress also passed a resolution expressing delegates' sympathy with the demands of the Ottoman Armenians that are based on decentralization, a measure bound to raise concerns in Istanbul. The delegates resolved to share their decisions with both the Porte and governments friendly to the Ottoman Empire. The Congress drew to a close on the night of 23 June. The Congress could not have chosen a more difficult moment to open negotiations with the Young Turks. The Ottomans had signed the Treaty of London, 30 May, marking the end of the First Balkan War with the loss of Albania, Macedonia, and Thrace, and Grand Vizier Mahmud Shevket Pasha had been assassinated on 11 June. The Unionists were in the midst of purging their liberal opponents from government as the Congress adjourned in Paris and were assuming power for the first time. Yet the meeting in Paris posed too great a threat to be ignored. If the Ottomans failed to respond, the Arabists would almost certainly turn to the European powers for support, and France had made no secret of its interests in Syria and Lebanon. The Young Turks dispatched their secretary-general, Midhat Şükrü, in a damage control exercise to engage Congress delegates in negotiations towards an agreed reform agenda. Tawfiq al-Suwaidi was suspicious of the Midhat Şükrü mission, which he claimed met with the fence-sitters with the express purpose of contacting said participants and drawing them over to the side of the Ottoman government. Yet the Ottoman mediators managed to conclude a reform agreement that went some way towards addressing the resolutions of the Arab Congress. The Paris Agreement offered to expand Arab participation in all levels of Ottoman government and to extend the use of the Arabic language, and confirmed that soldiers would serve in nearby countries. The Porte invited delegates of the Arab Congress to Istanbul to celebrate the Paris Agreement. The three delegates who accepted the invitation were given a warm reception in the imperial capital, where they met with the Crown Prince, Sultan Mehmed Reshad, Grand Vizier Said Halim Pasha, and the ruling triumvirate of Enver, Talat and Jamal. They were treated to lavish dinners and exchanged warm words of Turkish-Arab brotherhood with men at the highest level of the Ottoman government. Formal dinners and gracious speeches could not mask the fact that the Ottoman government was doing nothing to implement the reform agenda for the Arab lands. As Tawfiq al-Suwaidi concluded, those familiar with the internal state of affairs in the Ottoman Empire were of the belief that these phenomena were nothing more than stalling manoeuvres, and, when the time was right, a means of bearing down on those who had organized the Arab Congress. The delegates returned to Beirut empty-handed in September 1913. Arabist ambitions, raised by a flurry of activity, were ultimately disappointed. And, as Suwaidi suggested with the benefit of hindsight, the organizers of the Arab Congress were marked men. Within 3 years of the Arab Congress, several of their number met their deaths at the gallows for their Arabist politics. In the course of 5 years, the Ottoman Empire had endured a revolution, 3 major wars against foreign powers, and a number of internal disorders, ranging from sectarian massacres to separatist revolts, each of which threatened further foreign intervention. It is hard to overstate the magnitude of Ottoman losses during that period. The empire had surrendered the last of its possessions in North Africa and in the Balkans, together with millions of its subjects, to European rule. The resulting state of emergency drove Ottoman reformers to abandon their liberalism in a desperate bid to preserve the empire from total collapse. The constitutional movement of 1908 that challenged the Sultan's absolutism evolved through successive crises into a yet more autocratic government by the end of 1913, led by 3 idealistic unionists, Enver, Talat and Jamal. The liberation of Edirne had given the Ottoman Empire new hope for a better future. The Ottoman army had proven its ability to regain lost land. "Now we have an army to which one can entrust the interest of the country with confidence," Enver exulted, "and which is 1,000 times more capable of fulfilling its duty than at the start of this depressing war, in spite of all the losses we have suffered." Much though the territorial losses in North Africa and the Balkans were to be lamented, the Ottoman Empire had emerged as a contiguous territorial mass, spanning the Turkish and Arab provinces. The coherence and logic of such an Asian Muslim empire might better withstand internal and external challenges than had the old Ottoman Empire. The Unionists had hopes for a better future, but saw threats both within and outside Ottoman frontiers. They were concerned that the Arabs might succumb to their own nationalist movement, and saw Armenian ambitions as an existential threat to the Ottoman Empire. The provinces in eastern Anatolia that had been the focus of Armenian reform demands, endorsed by the European powers, represented the vital heartland of the Turkish provinces. The interaction between the Armenian communities across the Russo-Turkish frontier exacerbated the danger of Armenian separatism to the Ottoman Empire. The Young Turks saw Russia as the single greatest threat to Ottoman survival. With its territorial ambitions in eastern Anatolia, the Straits, and the Ottoman capital itself, Russia openly sought the demise of the Ottoman Empire. Great power ambitions could only be contained by the Ottomans in partnership with a friendly European power. The Ottoman Empire entered the fateful year of 1914 in search of such a defensive alliance. That search would ultimately draw the Ottomans into the Great War. 2. The Peace Before the Great War. Spring brought a new wave of optimism to the Ottoman Empire in 1914. Victory in the Second Balkan War and the recovery of Edirne and eastern Thrace had done wonders for national confidence. After years of wartime austerity, the Ottoman economy was the first beneficiary of peace. Demobilized soldiers returned to the workforce. Farmers predicted record harvests. A building boom was reported in towns across the Turkish and Arab provinces. Trade resumed with renewed vigor once the sea lanes were cleared of warships and mines. With the expansion of foreign trade came novel inventions of the modern age that, within the year, would be converted from civilian to military use. The advent of the automobile shattered the tranquility of Istanbul's streets. Until 1908, cars had been banned from the Ottoman Empire. When they were finally permitted after the Young Turk Revolution, the pioneers of Ottoman motoring encountered many obstacles. By and large, the streets of the empire were unpaved. Garages to service and fuel cars were few and far between. And there was no highway code, with chauffeurs disagreeing over such basic issues as the side of the road on which they should drive. Not surprisingly, very few cars had been sold in the Ottoman Empire since 1908. By the end of 1913, when there were already 1 million cars on the road in the United States, American consular officials estimated there were no more than 500 automobiles in the Ottoman Empire as a whole, with 250 of those in Istanbul. In a remote provincial town like Baghdad, you could literally count the number of cars on one hand. Yet, by mid-1914, the imperial capital was beginning to experience its first traffic jams, as limousines, touring cars, motor trucks, gasoline-driven delivery wagons and hospital ambulances jostled for space. The airplane also made its first appearance in the Ottoman Empire in the Young Turk era. Aviation was still in its infancy. The Wright brothers had only made their first successful flight in a mechanized, heavier-than-air craft in December 1903. 6 years later, aviation pioneer Louis Blériot came to Istanbul to demonstrate the marvels of flight. Blériot had recently achieved fame by flying a monoplane across the English Channel on 25 July 1909, and his visit to Istanbul was keenly anticipated. In the event, strong winds drove Blériot's airplane into the roof of an Istanbul house, and the pilot spent the next 3 weeks in a local hospital, recovering from his injuries. The first Turkish pilots were sent to Europe for training in 1911. By 1914, Turkish aviators were beginning to claim the skies above the Ottoman Empire. In February, Lieutenant Fethi Bey, accompanied by one of Enver Pasha's aides, Sadik Bey, attempted to fly from Istanbul across Anatolia and Syria to Egypt. Their plane, a Blériot design named the Muavenet-i Milliye, National Assistance, covered 125-mile leg from Tarsus to Adana in 20 minutes, at a speed in excess of 60 miles per hour. Crowds on the ground clapped as the plane flew overhead. They managed to reach Damascus safely, but their plane experienced engine problems on the flight to Jerusalem and crashed to the east of the Sea of Galilee, killing both pilots. Fethi Bey and Sadik Bey were laid to rest next to Saladin's tomb, in the Umayyad Mosque of Damascus, Turkey's first airmen to die in military service. A second air mission ended in a similar result before two pilots, Salim Bey and Kemal Bey, finally managed to complete the journey from Istanbul to Egypt in May 1914. In June 1914, American aviator John Cooper demonstrated the Curtiss flying boat to an audience of thousands in Istanbul. Taking off from the Sea of Marmara, he flew 15 miles at an average altitude of 1,000 feet before landing in the waters of the Bosporus between the European and Asian quarters of Istanbul. Members of the government, parliament, and imperial household witnessed the demonstration. Cooper then flew 7 flights with key dignitaries in the passenger seat, amid the applause and wonder of the spectators, to most of whom this sort of aviation was an entire novelty, an eyewitness recounted. All the major Istanbul papers carried the story with photographs the following day. The spread of mechanized transport fed the sense of optimism growing in the Ottoman Empire in the spring of 1914. With the negotiation of a $100 million public loan from France in May, the Ottoman government secured the means to invest in major public works projects that would bring electricity, public lighting, urban tramways, intercity railroads, and modern port facilities to all the provinces of the empire. The announcement of the French loan fed widespread expectations of a commercial and industrial boom. The French loan was the culmination of peace negotiations brokered by the European powers to resolve the outstanding differences between the Ottoman Empire and its neighbours in the aftermath of the Balkan Wars. The injection of French investment capital promised real economic growth and served as a powerful incentive for the Ottomans to accept their losses in Albania, Macedonia, and Thrace. Yet, even after the peace agreements had been signed and the French loan concluded, significant issues remained outstanding between Istanbul and Athens. The terms of the 1913 Treaty of London, concluding the First Balkan War, left Greece in possession of 3 Aegean islands seized from Turkey. Chios and Mytilene, dominating the entry to Smyrna, modern Izmir, were within sight of the Turkish mainland. Lemnos, with its deep-water Mudros harbour, was less than 50 miles from the Straits of the Dardanelles. The port never accepted the loss of these islands and was unwilling to live with Greece dominating its coastal waters. While Ottoman diplomats sought European support for their government's claims for the restoration of the Aegean islands, Ottoman war planners worked to shift the balance of naval power in the eastern Mediterranean. The Ottoman government commissioned 2 state-of-the-art dreadnoughts from the British shipbuilders Vickers and Armstrong in August 1911, scheduled for delivery in July 1914. The orders were placed as part of a British naval mission to help modernize the Ottoman fleet. The Sultan Osman and the Reshadiye, named for the eponymous founder of the Ottoman Empire and the reigning Sultan Mehmed Reshad, were a tremendous drain on the Ottoman treasury. Appealing to Ottoman patriotism, the government funded the ships in large part through public subscription. Turkish schoolchildren were encouraged to contribute their pocket money, and fundraising stands were erected in city squares, where, for contributions of 5 piastres or more, loyal citizens were invited to hammer nails into massive wood blocks. While the ships became a focus of Ottoman pride, redressing the empire's naval forces after the defeats in Libya and the First Balkan War, Greece and Russia watched with mounting concern as the dreadnoughts neared completion in the spring of 1914. The massive battleships would give the Turkish navy an overwhelming advantage over the Russian Black Sea fleet and the Greek navy in the Aegean. The Aegean Islands dispute and the impending delivery of the dreadnoughts raised the prospect of war between Greece and Turkey in 1914. Officials in Greece called for a preemptive strike to defeat the Ottomans before they took possession of the new naval vessels. The Ottomans prepared once again to conscript their citizens for war, sending notices in April 1914 to village headmen across the empire to warn of a possible mobilization and appealing to their loyalty to Islam in a way that fed rumors of war with Christian Greece. The prospect of renewed war between Greece and Turkey sounded alarm bells in St. Petersburg. The Russians, though no less concerned about the naval balance of power than the Greeks, were more immediately preoccupied with keeping Ottoman waters open for Russian Black Sea shipping. 50% of Russia's exports, including 90% of its grain exports, passed through the Turkish Straits. Renewed war in the Aegean would result in an Ottoman closure of the straits and the bottling of Russian trade, with catastrophic consequences for the Russian economy. Russia thus exercised its diplomacy to keep Greece from going to war with Turkey, while putting pressure on Britain to delay delivery of the ships to the Ottoman navy. Russian diplomacy entailed ulterior motives. Convinced that the demise of the Ottoman Empire was imminent, the Tsar and his government wished to stake a claim to those territories of key strategic value to Russia in any future partition of Ottoman lands by the European powers. Russia's top priorities included reclaiming Constantinople for Orthodox Christianity after nearly 5 centuries under Turkish Muslim rule, and controlling the straits linking Russia's Black Sea ports to the Mediterranean. St. Petersburg was thus determined to prevent any war that might result in Ottoman territory coveted by Russia from passing into Greek or Bulgarian hands. The Russian Council of Ministers met in February 1914 to consider the occupation of Constantinople and the Straits, and concurred that the best opportunity would arise in the context of a general European war. Tsar Nicholas II approved his cabinet's recommendations in April 1914 and committed his government to creating the necessary forces to occupy Istanbul and the Straits at the earliest possible opportunity. While planning to annex the Ottoman capital, the Russians were also looking to consolidate their position in Ottoman territory in eastern Anatolia. The eastern borderlands of the Ottoman Empire shared frontiers with Russia's volatile Caucasus provinces and gave access to northwestern Iran, a zone of rivalry between Russia and Great Britain. Eastern Anatolia also corresponded to the 6 provinces that the European powers had identified as the territory inhabited by the Armenians: Erzurum, Van, Bitlis, Harput, Diyarbakir, and Sivas. Perhaps 1.25 million Armenians lived on the Russian side of the border, and as many as 1 million Armenians resided in the 6 Ottoman provinces of eastern Anatolia, recognized by the international community as Turkish Armenia. The Tsar's government had used the defense of indigenous Armenian rights as a pretext to intervene in Ottoman affairs since 1878. Because of Russia's ambitions in Ottoman territory, its efforts exacerbated tensions between the Ottomans and the Armenians. Real tensions had re-emerged between Armenians and Kurds in the years following the Young Turk Revolution. Some of the Armenians who fled the violence of the 1890s attempted to reclaim their homes and villages after the 1908 revolution. Some Kurdish tribesmen who had occupied properties abandoned by the Armenians refused to recognize the claims of prior owners. Already in 1909, land disputes between Armenians and Kurds had led to violence, and the Kurds enjoyed the upper hand. The nomadic Kurds were much better armed than the sedentary Armenians, and Ottoman officials seldom took the side of the Christian Armenians over the Muslim Kurds. The situation was aggravated when Ottoman troops were redeployed from eastern Anatolia to fight in the Libyan and Balkan Wars, and when Armenian conscripts were sent to the Balkan front in 1912. Armenian farmers were left to their own defenses in an increasingly tense conflict with the Kurds. Russia stepped into the power vacuum in June 1913, with reform proposals for greater Armenian autonomy in eastern Anatolia. Drawing on Sultan Abdulhamid II's 1895 reform edict for the Armenians, the Russian plan called for the 6 eastern provinces of the Ottoman Empire to be consolidated into 2 semi-autonomous provinces, administered by foreign governors general nominated by the great powers. The proposal also called for provincial councils, composed of an equal number of Muslim and Armenian deputies. European and Ottoman diplomats alike viewed the proposals with grave misgivings as a prelude to partition in Anatolia, with Russia staking a claim to the eastern provinces. St. Petersburg reinforced its diplomacy by proposing a troop mobilization, not just along the Russo-Turkish frontier, but also inside Ottoman territory in the city of Erzurum itself, ostensibly to defend the Armenians. To forestall militarizing the situation, the Porte agreed to a revised reform proposal with the Russian government, which was signed on 8 February 1914. The Armenian reform proposal only deferred conflict with Russia and exacerbated the Young Turks' problems with the Armenians. The Ottoman government viewed the reform plan as a prelude to Armenian statehood and an existential threat. The Young Turks were determined to prevent the implementation of the reform plan at all costs. Talat Pasha, the Minister of Interior and one of the ruling triumvirs, began to plan extraordinary measures to remove the Armenians from the six provinces and thus obviate the need for such reforms. Negotiations between the Young Turk government and the Russians revealed just how isolated the Ottoman Empire had become in the international arena. The Porte was all too aware of the danger Russia posed to the territorial integrity of the empire. While normally the Ottomans could rely on Britain or France to hold Russia's ambitions in check, those three powers were now allies in the Triple Entente. Neither Britain nor France could be counted on to side with the Ottoman Empire. In dangerous times, the Ottomans needed a strong friend. The leading candidate was Germany. German-Ottoman friendship ran relatively deep. In 1898, Kaiser Wilhelm II made a state visit to the Ottoman Empire. Starting in Istanbul, he travelled across the Turkish and Arab provinces, visiting key cities and historic sites. In Damascus, the Kaiser famously pledged Germany's perpetual friendship to the Ottomans in particular, and to the Muslims of the world in general. May the Sultan and his 300 million Muslim subjects scattered across the earth, who venerate him as their caliph, be assured that the German Kaiser will be their friend for all time. Wilhelm's declaration of amity was not entirely disinterested. In his rivalry with the older, more established British Empire, the Kaiser saw opportunities for Germany to extend its influence in partnership with the Ottoman Empire. Wilhelm believed friendship with the Ottoman Sultan, who was also recognized as caliph, or successor to the Prophet Muhammad as leader of the global Muslim community, would make Muslims around the world more sympathetic to Germany than to any other European power. With over 100 million Muslims under British rule in India, the Persian Gulf, and Egypt, Germany saw the potential to deploy Islam as a weapon against the British, should the need arise. Turkey also held a geostrategic position of importance for Germany. At the time of the Kaiser's visit, Britain and Russia were locked in an intense rivalry for predominance over Central Asia that came to be known as the Great Game. The Turkish provinces of eastern Anatolia were a gateway to both Persia and Central Asia. Germany could become a player in the Great Game and put pressure on both Britain and Russia through an alliance with the Ottomans. The southern frontiers of the Ottoman Empire reached the Persian Gulf. Here, Germany hoped to encroach on a jealously guarded British lake. In the course of the 19th century, the British had managed to check the Ottomans and European powers alike through a system of exclusive treaties binding the Arab rulers in the Trucial States, today the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait, to the British Crown. Following the Kaiser's 1898 visit to the Ottoman Empire, Germany sought to exploit its new partnership with the Turks to challenge Britain's monopoly over the Persian Gulf by means of a railway linking Berlin to Baghdad. Following the Kaiser's visit, Germany secured a concession in December 1899 to build a railway across Turkey to Basra on the Persian Gulf via Baghdad. Construction on the line began in 1903. By 1914, it linked Istanbul to Ankara and the Mediterranean coast near Adana. The railway had run into unexpected difficulties in two mountain chains in Cilicia, however, and fallen well behind schedule. While most of the line in Anatolia was complete, great lengths of the railway remained under construction in Syria and Iraq. The first train pulled out of the station in Baghdad with little fanfare on 1 June 1914. The line ran northward for 38.5 miles to an empty spot in the desert named Sumeikha. Undeterred by the lack of public interest in the train to nowhere, the railway company printed timetables and distributed them to government offices, foreign consulates, clubs, and hotels. Work continued apace, and in October 1914 the line reached the town of Samara. The northbound train departed Baghdad once each week at 10 a.m. and covered the 74-mile distance in 4 hours, at an average speed of just under 20 miles per hour. The return train departed Samarra for Baghdad each Thursday morning at 10 a.m. The dream of a direct link between Baghdad and Berlin remained remote, yet the project served to bind Germany and the Ottoman Empire closer during a turbulent time in European affairs. Deepening ties between Berlin and Istanbul provoked a crisis in European affairs with the appointment of a German military mission to the Ottoman Empire at the end of 1913. Grand Vizier Said Halim Pasha asked Kaiser Wilhelm II to nominate an experienced general to lead a team of mid-ranking German officers to assist in the reform and reorganization of the Ottoman army in the wake of the Balkan Wars. The Kaiser nominated the Prussian Otto Liemann von Sonders for the job. Liemann was at the time commander of the 22nd Division of the German Army, based in Kassel. He had served for years on the general staff and had travelled widely, but had no prior experience in the Ottoman Empire. Liemann accepted the commission without hesitation and set off by train for Istanbul in mid-December 1913. Shortly after his arrival, Liemann met with Sultan Mehmed Reshad, the Grand Vizier, and the leading triumvirate of Young Turks. The German general was impressed by Interior Minister Talat's charm and attractive personality, and remarked that Cemal Pasha, commander of the First Army Corps, combined great intelligence with a very determined attitude. However, he fell out with Enver Pasha almost immediately. No doubt, Enver, celebrated months earlier as the liberator of Edirne, resented having a German officer hold the Turkish army to account. While Liemann was very critical of the deplorable state in which he found the Ottoman army, with its ragged uniforms, pestilential barracks, and underfed and underpaid soldiers, he did not see these as Enver's failings. Rather, the German general believed Enver had been promoted beyond his experience and ability. The issue came to the fore in January 1914, when the Committee of Union and Progress named Enver Minister of War. The astonished Sultan Mehmed Reshad seemed to speak for Liemann when he read of the appointment in the newspaper. "It is stated here that Enver has become Minister of War. That is unthinkable. He is much too young." The Russian government had opposed the appointment of the German military mission from the outset. St. Petersburg's opposition developed into a crisis when Cemal Pasha handed over to Liemann command of the Ottoman First Army Corps, with responsibility for the security of Istanbul and the Straits. For the Russians, this was tantamount to Germany seizing control of territory in which St. Petersburg had a vested interest. The Tsar's government threatened to occupy the eastern Anatolian city of Erzurum to redress such a change in the balance of power. Britain and France were determined to prevent Russian retaliatory measures that would almost certainly lead to a premature partition of the Ottoman Empire. Yet the British were in a difficult position. After all, since 1912, a British admiral, Arthur Limpus, had led a 72-man naval mission to the Ottoman Empire and served as commander-in-chief of the Ottoman Navy. Rather than seek the disbanding of the German military mission, British diplomats suggested Liemann might take control of the Second Army Corps, and so relinquish control of the army in Istanbul and the Straits. Liemann, unwilling to compromise his commission due to political pressure, rejected all efforts to transfer his command to a different army corps. In the end, the Kaiser came up with a solution by promoting Liemann to a rank too high for command of an army corps. Liemann became a field marshal, and command of the First Army Corps passed to an Ottoman officer. Germany and the Ottoman Empire had weathered the crisis together, strengthening the bonds between the two states. By the summer of 1914, the Ottoman Empire was swinging manically between the optimism of its economic boom and the crises in its foreign relations. The contradiction was resolved catastrophically, with the assassination of the Austrian Crown Prince, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, in the Bosnian city of Sarajevo on 28 June 1914. The assassination activated the web of open and secret alliances that divided Europe into two belligerent blocs. The fact that the Ottoman Empire lay outside that treacherous network of alliances was of no comfort to the Porte. The looming prospect of a European general war raised the imminent threat of a Russian annexation of Istanbul, the Straits, and eastern Anatolia, and the ultimate dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire among the Entente powers. France was known to covet Syria, Britain had interests in Mesopotamia, and Greece wished to expand its grip over the Aegean. The Ottomans alone had no chance of defending their territory against so many enemies. Weary of war and in need of time to rebuild its military and economy, the Ottoman leadership had no wish to enter a general European conflict. Rather, it sought an ally to protect the empire's vulnerable territory from the consequences of such a war. The Ottomans' turn to Germany was not a foregone conclusion. A fascinating aspect of Ottoman diplomacy during the July crisis was the Porte's openness to concluding a defensive alliance with virtually any European power. The three young Turk leaders had different views on potential allies. Enver and Talat were known to lean towards an alliance with Germany, while Jamal believed that only an Entente power could exercise restraint over Russian ambitions in Ottoman territory. He was himself a Francophile, and there were good reasons to look to the French for a defensive alliance. France was the Ottomans' chief financial creditor since the conclusion of the $100 million public loan in May 1914. Should France demur, Jemal saw Britain as a good alternative. For most of the 19th century, Britain had been the staunchest proponent of preserving the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire. More recently, Britain had assisted with the restructuring of the Ottoman navy, through the Limpus naval mission and the construction of new ships of the line for the Ottoman fleet. Since becoming Minister of Marine, Jemal had worked closely with the British naval mission and respected its professionalism. It was thus natural that Jemal would look to either Britain or France to secure the assurances his government needed for the protection of the territorial integrity of the empire. In early July 1914, shortly after the assassination in Sarajevo, Jemal visited France on the government's invitation to attend French naval manoeuvres. He took advantage of his visit to Europe to meet with the Ottoman officers liaising with the British shipbuilders, who were putting the finishing touches to the new Ottoman dreadnoughts. The officers reported to Jemal that the English were in a very peculiar frame of mind. They seemed to be always searching for some new excuse for delaying the completion and delivery of the warships. Jemal instructed his officers to return and take delivery of the ships as soon as possible, leaving any final fittings for the Ottoman shipyards in Istanbul to complete. After attending the French fleet review in Toulon, Jemal Pasha returned to Paris to call on the French Foreign Ministry. In his discussions with the Director of Political Affairs, Jemal came straight to the point. "You must take us into your Entente, and at the same time protect us against the terrible perils threatening us from Russia." In return, Jemal promised Turkey would be a faithful ally in helping France and Britain forge an iron ring around the Central Powers. The French diplomat responded cautiously that his government could only enter into an alliance with the Ottomans with their allies' approval, which seemed very doubtful. Jemal recognized the response for a refusal. "I understood perfectly that France was convinced that it was quite impossible for us to escape the iron claws of Russia, and that under no circumstances would she vouchsafe us her help." On 18 July, Jemal left Paris to return to Istanbul empty-handed. On 28 July 1914, 1 month after the assassination in Sarajevo, the Habsburg Empire declared war on Serbia. What began as a Balkan conflict quickly dragged Europe's greatest military powers into total war. Russia, bound by an alliance to Serbia, responded by threatening war with Austria-Hungary. Germany stood by its partner, Austria, and Russia's allies, Britain and France, entered the fray. By 4 August, the Triple Entente was at war with Germany and Austria. The outbreak of war in Europe provoked alarm across the Ottoman Empire, from the cabinet offices of the Sublime Porte through the towns and countryside of Anatolia and the Arab lands. The need for a defensive alliance to assure the territorial integrity of the empire became critical. The Young Turks knew from Jemal's reports that there was no prospect of such an agreement with France. His trust in Britain was likewise soon to be betrayed. On 1 August, 3 days before declaring war on Germany, the British government requisitioned the 2 dreadnoughts commissioned by the Ottomans. The news stunned Cemal Pasha, who, as Minister of Marine, had viewed the new ships as the cornerstone of Ottoman naval reform. He recalled his discussions with the Ottoman naval officers in Paris and realized that the repeated British delays had been nothing but pretexts which revealed the design England had long cherished of making these ships her own. Given that the ships had been paid for in full, to a great extent through public contributions, the British decision to requisition the ships was treated as a national humiliation in Turkey and ruled out the possibility of any accord between Britain and the Ottoman Empire. The very next day, 2 August 1914, the Ottomans concluded a secret treaty of alliance with Germany. The Austrians first proposed drawing the Ottoman Empire into the Triple Alliance in mid-July 1914. Vienna hoped to isolate Serbia and to neutralize Bulgaria by concluding an agreement with Istanbul. The Germans at first rejected the idea. Both the German ambassador to Istanbul, Baron Hans von Wangenheim, and General Liman von Saunders, the head of the German military mission, believed the Ottomans would prove more of a liability than an ally in both diplomatic and military terms. Turkey, Wangenheim wrote to Berlin on 18 July, is today without any question still worthless as an ally. She would only be a burden to her associates without being able to offer them the slightest advantage. Enver Talat and Grand Vizier Said Halim Pasha argued the case for a German-Ottoman alliance with Wangenheim through the latter part of July. They warned that the Ottomans would be forced to seek the support of the Entente powers through an alliance with Greece if Germany would not come to terms with them. When Wangenheim reported back to Berlin, Kaiser Wilhelm II came down in favour of concluding an agreement with the Ottoman Empire. After 2 decades of cultivating German-Ottoman friendship, the Kaiser was appalled at the idea of driving the Turks into the arms of the Russians and the French. On 24 July, Wilhelm instructed his ambassador in Istanbul to comply with the Ottoman request immediately. A refusal or a snub would amount to her going over to Russo-Gallia, the Kaiser exclaimed, and our influence would be gone once and for all. By 27 July, the Germans and Ottomans had worked out the terms of a secret defensive alliance against Russia. The 8 articles of the strikingly simple document would come into effect only in the event of Russian hostilities against either side, which, with the German declaration of war on Russia on 1 August, was a near certainty at the time of signing. Crucially, Germany pledged to protect the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire against Russian ambitions. The treaty placed the German military mission under the authority of the Ottoman government in return for assurances that the mission would have an effective influence over the general conduct of the army. The alliance was to last until the end of 1918, with scope for renewal by agreement of both sides. The one condition that Germany did not commit to paper was that, on entering the war, the Ottomans would open military operations immediately against either Russia or the British in Egypt, in a bid to rouse Muslim subjects in their empires to rise up against the Entente powers. On the eve of signing the pact with Germany, Enver Pasha, as Minister of War, called for a general mobilization. All men between the ages of 20 and 45 were required to register for the draft, and all reservists were told to report to their units. The mobilization hit the Ottoman public like a bombshell, though it demonstrated to their German allies that the young Turks intended to uphold their commitments. Yet the Ottomans, who had been so impatient to conclude a defensive alliance, were in no hurry to enter a world war. A spectacular crash in August followed the economic boom of the first half of 1914. With young men called up for military service, there would be no labourers to tend the fields or work in the factories. Trade prospects, once so promising, collapsed in the certain knowledge that all Ottoman ports would be closed to shipping by the hostilities. army quartermasters began to requisition food, livestock and materiel to provide for the needs of the army under full mobilization. Turkish families began to plan for the worst. After three wars in quick succession, they knew how badly further conflict would upset their lives. İrfan Orga, a native of Istanbul, was only 6 years old in 1914. The war shattered the prosperity he had known all his young life. Some of his earliest memories were of heated family discussions after the outbreak of war in Europe. He remembered sneaking out of bed one evening that summer to eavesdrop on the adults. It was very still, and I could hear every word of the conversation. My father appeared to be attempting to persuade my grandmother to sell our house. "Nonsense," his grandmother retorted. "Why should a war in Europe make any difference in our lives?" Orga's father astonished his family by declaring his intention to sell not just the family home, but their carpet exporting business as well. "It is necessary to sell it, if we are to survive at all," he explained. "There are so many difficulties, labor, export, bad representation abroad. Now the war in Europe writes finis to all my hopes of markets there. If Turkey comes in, and in my opinion she will, I shall have to go." His father, only 26 years old, knew he would face conscription in the event of war. "It is better to get rid of it now, and if one day I come back, well, with our name, it is easy to build the business again." A stunned silence fell over the family. These conversations were the first hint of the changes that were to come, Orga reflected. In due course, both the family home and business were sold to provide the food and capital Orga's father believed they would need to see them through what threatened to be a long and devastating war for Turkey. Even these precautions proved insufficient to protect the Orga family from the extreme poverty caused by the conflict. Trade to the Ottoman Empire ground to a halt on 3 August, when the government closed the straits. The harbour master informed all foreign governments that the Ottoman navy had laid mines at the entrance to both the Bosporus from the Black Sea and the Dardanelles from the Mediterranean, as well as extinguished all navigational lights and removed signal buoys. Between 4 August and 26 September, the Ottomans operated a tug service to convey vessels safely through the minefields. On 27 September, the tug service was discontinued, and the straits were definitively closed to commercial shipping. The effect on Ottoman trade was immediate and catastrophic, although the Russians felt the pain too. The severing of maritime access from the Black Sea to international markets left hundreds of their ships filled with grain and other supplies trapped in the Black Sea. The German navy was the first to seek entry into the restricted straits. Shortly after declaring war on France, the German Mediterranean squadron set off for the coast of North Africa to disrupt the transport of troops from Algeria to France. The Goeben, a heavy battleship, and the light cruiser Breslau, bombarded the coastal cities of Bern, modern Annaba, and Philippeville, modern Skikda, on 4 August. The raid inflicted casualties and provoked panic along the coastline of North Africa. The British, who had declared war on Germany that same day, ordered their Mediterranean fleet to sink the German ships, and were joined by the aggrieved French fleet in hot pursuit of the Goeben and Breslau as they set off towards the eastern Mediterranean. The German Admiralty had already given orders to the commander of the naval squadron, Rear Admiral Wilhelm Souchon, whose French surname revealed his Huguenot ancestry, to make for Turkish waters. In a meeting with Germany's ambassador and the head of the military mission, Liman von Sonders, in Istanbul on 1 August, Enver Pasha specifically requested the dispatch of German warships to Ottoman waters before concluding the defensive alliance with Germany. This would compensate for the loss of the dreadnoughts requisitioned by Britain earlier that day and tip the naval balance of power with Russia in the Black Sea. Ambassador Wangenheim secured Berlin's consent in the expectation that the German ships would be used to draw Turkey into the war and open a new front with Russia. The Germans had clear interests in sending their ships into Turkish waters. They knew their vessels were outgunned by the British and the French, and the Goeben had boiler trouble. If left in open waters, the German ships faced certain destruction. Moreover, Chancellor Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg asserted that the presence of German warships in Turkish waters would render Ottoman neutrality untenable. The inevitable crisis would force the port back onto its secret alliance with Germany, which would demand immediate Ottoman action against either Russia in the east or against Britain in Egypt. Either way, the German ships would be in Ottoman waters to open new fronts against the Entente, shifting the balance of power in Germany's favour. The Ottomans turned the German naval crisis to advantage. Though Enver had requested the dispatch of the German ships in the first place, he did so without his government's authority, and the port initially refused the approaching warships' haven. In a pre-dawn meeting with Ambassador Wangenheim on 6 August, Prime Minister Said Halim relented, laying out his government's conditions for allowing the Goeben and Breslau to enter the straits. Said Halim insisted that the German ships could do nothing to jeopardize Ottoman neutrality in the rapidly expanding European conflict. He then went on to present 6 demands of Germany that represent the earliest statement of Ottoman aims for the First World War. Said Halim first demanded that Germany assist the Ottomans in the abolition of the capitulations, a series of ancient bilateral treaties that conferred trade privileges and extraterritorial legal rights to Europeans living and working in Ottoman domains. The Ottomans had conferred the capitulations at the height of their power on the then weaker European states to facilitate trade relations. The earliest capitulations were awarded to Italian city-states in the 14th century, and the system was extended to Britain and France in the 16th century. By the 20th century, when the Ottoman Empire was far weaker than its European neighbours, the capitulations had evolved into unequal treaties that compromised Ottoman sovereignty in important ways. The Ottomans hoped to take advantage of a major European war to be rid of them, and wanted German support in a unilateral action that they knew would provoke outrage in the courts of Europe. 2 of Said Halim's conditions addressed recent Ottoman losses in the Balkan Wars. The Ottomans were determined to secure agreements with Romania and Bulgaria before entering hostilities against the Triple Entente to ensure that its Balkan neighbours would not threaten Turkish Thrace or Istanbul. The Grand Vizier sought German assistance both in concluding the indispensable understandings with Romania and Bulgaria and in negotiating a fair agreement with Bulgaria for an equitable division of possible spoils of war. 2, should Greece enter the war on the side of the Entente powers and be defeated, Germany would assure the return of the 3 Aegean islands of Chios, Mytilene, and Lemnos to Turkish sovereignty. The Ottoman government also sought territorial gains at Russia's expense. In the event of a victory over the Entente, the Porte wanted Germany to secure for Turkey a small correction of her eastern border that would place Turkey into direct contact with the Muslims of Russia. The Ottomans wanted back the 3 provinces ceded to Russia in 1878. They also wanted Germany to withhold any peace agreement with the defeated European powers until any Ottoman territory occupied in the course of the war had been evacuated by foreign troops and returned to Ottoman sovereignty, basically a restatement of the territorial guarantees central to the German-Turkish Treaty of Alliance. Finally, Said Halim asked the German ambassador to ensure that Turkey would receive an appropriate war indemnity for its efforts. The German ambassador had little choice but to concede to the Grand Vizier's demands on the spot. It was the middle of the night, the German ships were fast approaching, and most of the conditions only applied in the event of Ottoman assistance to a German victory. Yet, in conceding to Ottoman demands, Wangenheim set a precedent of the weaker Ottoman partner forcing important concessions from its German ally that would continue until the end of the war. On the afternoon of 10 August, the German ships appeared off the Turkish coast. Enver Pasha sent a telegram to the commander of the Ottoman forts at the Dardanelles, ordering him to allow the Breslau and Goeben to enter the strait. The next morning, a Turkish torpedo boat was dispatched to guide the ships safely through the recently mined waters to a secure anchorage inside the Dardanelles. No sooner had the German ships entered the Dardanelles than the British and French ambassadors called on the Grand Vizier to protest against the decision to allow the German ships into Ottoman territorial waters as an infringement of Ottoman neutrality. That evening, 11 August, the young Turk triumvirate met